The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, good evening, everyone. How's everybody feeling tonight? Good, good. Well, my name is Andrew Simon. I'm the co-author of the book, Racing While Black, How an African-American Stock Car Team Made Its Mark on NASCAR. And we're here to have a discussion about the book. So for about a half hour, I'm going to talk with the author of the book, Leonard T. Miller, and his father, Leonard W. Miller. And after that, we're going to open up the floor to some questions. And after that, we hope you all join us out in the lobby for a book signing, and you can also buy some books out there. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the stage Leonard T. Miller and Leonard W. Miller. So we don't have a script here, so we just want to have a nice discussion about the book. I also wanted to mention towards the beginning that Racing While Black has already been nominated as one of the top 12 books to read by Auto Week. So please be mindful of that. Yes, thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and direct the first question to you, Lenny, as I've been calling you Lenny for about 2.5, 3 years now, I think. Let's just start with the obvious question. Why did you do this book?
There's several reasons. Basically, to document my father and I, our history that we had in this present effort that started in 1993, developing stock car drivers for NASCAR. And we found that in the industry, a lot of the black history and efforts are either swept under the rug where they're forgotten because the few efforts that were out there, I mean, most folks don't take the time to either write a book. They're just trying to survive on the racetrack. NASCAR now has a diversity program, which in my opinion is a ceremonial program for photo opportunities and give the look that African Americans are interested in the sport and everything is okay. I wrote the book, you know, along with you to voice my opinions and our experience, to give a real hardcore perspective of what my dad and I went through in the Carolinas at the grassroots level in NASCAR. Also, the book, the purpose for the book is to destroy some of the myths that are out there. A lot of the press, national press and some of the grassroots press in auto racing, they claim that blacks don't pay their dues in the sport. They claim that blacks aren't interested in auto racing as far as competing, and that black drivers do not start out early enough. You're supposed to start out at 5 years old, and a lot of those press releases and articles and history are false. I've seen it from CNN to USA Today to some of the grassroots magazines. That say that blacks start out racing too late, and that's why they're not in the sport, and that's absolutely, you know, not true.
Now, Mr. Miller, as I like to call you, you were the owner of a team that entered a black driver into the Indianapolis 500. Why was it important for you over the years to make a concerted effort to get a black driver into the higher echelons of racing?
One correction. We entered Benny Scott in the Long Beach Grand Prix, and Long Beach Grand Prix is one of the top 60 teams in the world. We had a white driver with a black team in the Indy 500. And in the Indy 500, we... As owners, it was Brig Owens of the Washington Redskins, Paul Jackson, the largest black contractor in the United States at that time. He was grossing $60 million a year. And Richard Deutsch, who was a friend of the Kennedy family, was part of the effort, and that's how we got to the Indy 500. But I've been around most of the black pioneers in the United States that were big in the 1920s and 30s, and they always had a desire to go to the Indy 500 or any of the top echelon races in the world, and they kind of left it up to me. They said, Len, we can't go any further. You have to move things along, and that's what motivated me to stick with developing black drivers.
Now, Lenny, can you talk a little bit about the importance of sponsorship and what that means for getting an effort off the ground and for sustaining an effort?
Yeah, sponsorship, unlike most other sports, stick and ball sports, that don't require sponsorship. You need actually, talent in the sport. If you're a baseball player, I mean, it's an athletic sport. I mean, you don't need money compared to auto racing. Auto racing at any level, whether it's go-karts, drag racing, stock car racing, open wheel racing, at the entry levels, it takes tens of thousands of dollars to start out per year, and in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you don't know if you're starting out with a new driver or trying to develop a driver, you don't even know if that driver has any talent until you spend maybe over $1 million. So that's the difference between auto racing and other stick and ball sports. So if you don't have a sponsor, you can't participate in the sport at any level. And usually starting out, you start out with your own disposable income and savings, which my father has done over the years. And then together we did that, which is outlined in the book, starting in 1993. My father would buy the chassis, it's $15,000 or $20,000, and then I would pitch in $15,000 or $20,000 for the engine. And that's how you start.
Yeah,
and I would like to add something. Most of the black drivers, past and present, had to do impossible feats. In the audience tonight is the father of one of the most famous black drivers in the world today, Antoine Brown's father. Stand up.
Yeah.
This is. We've been friends for many years. His son is the last entry in this book, and his son has done 319 miles an hour in a quarter mile, set the record. Now, why I bring that up is all the black drivers, including Antron, had to do impossible feats. His son was 200 miles an hour with motorcycles in a quarter mile, shoot, just like that. Your eyeballs go back in your head. I mean, it's tough. He had to switch over, and he had to do 17 passes to go out on the track, and he had to get 300 miles an hour. The white drivers take 10 years to do that. They're developed along so and so and so. John Griswold's in here, and Alex Maynard, and a few guys, and Doc Watson especially, on the ovals, we have to do with half the amount of money to get a lot out of the car. And if you can't fail, because you never have enough money. I just wanted to add that just as a thing.
That's a good segue, because across the board in the sport of NASCAR and in auto racing in general, as I've learned in this process, is getting money from corporate sponsors is not easy regardless of skin color. I mean, it's just, money isn't necessarily just thrown around. So if you would tell us, Lenny, and tell the audience, take us into a boardroom meeting that you have with a potential sponsor and what those meetings are like, the feedback that you get.
Yeah, the typical meeting, I've been to 60 Fortune 500 companies in the last 15 years for sponsorship. And we would research, my father and I, every company's different. So they sell different products to different people. They sell them in a different way. So we would do research on the company and then pitch the company an auto racing platform to help them sell their products and services. And including in that, you'd always include in auto racing the demographics, who comes to the racetrack, what age is, racial makeup, gender, how many people are in the stands, television coverage, if any, is it national, international, regional. And most marketing departments and companies, they're trying to separate their product and kind of cut through the clutter, if you will, to stand out. So having an African-American driver in auto racing, which is 99.9% white, you would have, you would achieve that goal by having some added value and having a driver that stands out from a marketing perspective. So when we go into the meeting, all the corporate executives would agree wholeheartedly on that point that I just described. And then they would hem and haw and say that, well, we really can't commit. Sometimes they would lie and say their budgets are expended. And then most cases, 90% of the time, they would send you to diversity and say, "This is since you guys are African-American, this is a diversity project. It's not marketing. It's not advertising."
And what's the difference in dollar value in those different facets of the company?
Yeah, yeah. Diversity is a handout. It's geared up for nonprofit.
Right.
Go to black functions for photo ops to make the company look good in the public. A white team will go in with the same proposal and without even added value, just a traditional team, and they're never escorted to a nonprofit wing of the company. And that's been the dilemma for us for the whole time since the beginning of the book, 93, and even back to the 70s.
I want to add a couple things to Lenny's comments. When it comes to marketing in major corporations, black money is lumped into one pot. I think Doc Watson can come here and say this exact same thing. So if the corporation has $500,000 available, they pick what a black organization the money goes to. So if the NAACP gets $100,000, the Urban League gets $100,000, Reverend Jesse Jackson makes sure he gets $200,000, and then Reverend Sharpton gets $100,000, we get nothing. It's lumped in together. As far as the white community is concerned, auto racers go to the auto racing budget, which is another division. For example, Miller Beer in auto racing used to put in $120 million a year. Coca-Cola puts in $80 million a year. You have Budweiser puts in $100 million a year. Pet Boys, many years, had put in a lot of money. Pet Boys right here in Philadelphia, Mandy Moe and Jack. You go, the black community made Pep Boys. In the 70s and the 80s, Pep Boys was kept in business by the black community. We went into Pep Boys. Pep Boys says, well, we have your business. We're trying to get white business. And then Lenny will go into another corporation. They said, we have to reinforce our marketing with the white community of America, so we don't have enough money to help the black. You see, you're caught in both ways. And we also even, we all love Dr. Martin Luther King. We love him to death. And to make a long story short, we even get hit with that. People say, we gave $1 million to the Martin Luther King statue. Therefore, we have no more money to put into marketing with black racing teams. You hear Danny Bakewell of the National Publishers Association talking about boycotting General Motors. Well, that's good and that's bad, but Ford Motor Company, for example, has never given any decent money into the black racing community since the 60s. Not since the 60s. And what they do, they say, okay, if we give the Urban League money, you don't get any money. If we give the Miller Racing Group money, then Antron Brown doesn't get any money. And he's in the drag racing. That's a different budget. These are big hidden budgets in America. And right now, just like in NASCAR, for example, you can have a chief mechanic, 8th grade or 12th grade education, and never even hardly went to vocational school, but get $500,000 salary base salary. $500,000. With bonuses, it's $800,000 take home pay a year. And all of these things are going on behind the scenes, and we're lumped. Like Tiger Woods is used with Buick. For example, Tiger Woods was getting $26 million a year. So he said, well, that's it for the blacks. Tiger Woods gets $26 million, everybody else is out. Well, that isn't the way it should work, but I wanted to add that.
Yeah, and speaking of behind the scenes, I wanted to ask you, Lenny, to talk a little bit about the stereotype of NASCAR being, as you said, 99% white, not just white, but Southern in its fan base, working class in its fan base. There's some difficulties there. Can you tell the audience and take us a little bit into what the pit areas are like, what the grandstands are like at a track like Concord, where you had your NASCAR operation start?
Yeah, it's very, NASCAR is primarily Southern, but it's very blue-collar, working-class crowd. And most blacks, like our father and I, have invited plenty of people to the racetrack, and they're very uncomfortable sitting in the stands and in the pits. There's still rebel flags out at some of these racetracks. It's very Southern. It's almost like going back in time in some cases, which are described in the book. So until there's about 5 or 10, I don't know what the number is, but there'll be multiple black drivers in the circuit, not just one token or just one woman, but several black drivers before blacks would even consider coming to the racetrack.
I would like to add something to that. To win the Daytona 500, a black athlete has to stick together in breaking into any sport. We can go back to Harlem Globetrotters or what they did with against George Mikan and the Lakers and so on. But to win the Daytona 500, this would be the scenario. You need one black driver like Jackie Robinson. You need another black driver on the grid like Terrell Owens. You need another black driver, the third one would be Donovan McNabb. And the fourth one would be Chief Justice Clarence Thomas. And he'll try to block and wreck the other four. But that's what you're going to need. You need those four. You need those. That scenario. And a black driver will win the Daytona 500.
And on the Clarence Thomas note, the NASCAR, since they're confused on how to go about getting black drivers in the sport, they'll invite prominent black figures to come to their racetrack to either drive the pace car, sing the national anthem, just be seen on the camera. So they'll fly in. Clarence Thomas has been to a NASCAR race maybe 8-10 years ago. They'll fly in Colin Powell. And then they politicized the sport. They flew in, I think, George Bush and Condoleezza Rice at least once, if not twice, when they're in office, and they're put on television. So if you're, from a business standpoint, if you're trying to get black fans and 90% of the black vote Democrat, why would you fly in George Bush and Condoleezza Rice? I mean, you're not going to get the fans. And 90% of the blacks have no respect for Clarence Thomas, maybe even 98%. So why would you have Clarence Thomas come to the racetrack? And then most people, I mean, blacks are sophisticated. If you see a Michael Jordan, they had Michael Jordan bursting out of some kind of paper wall, I think the Charlotte, what they call an all-star race at the end of May. Well, you know he's paid or has been invited because you never see him in a racetrack ever again. And it's ceremonial, and it's trying to pull the wool over potential black fans. But NASCAR, they think that's the right way to go about it. But to date, they don't have a significant number of black fans.
Well, let's stay on that subject because NASCAR over the years has launched different programs that have been presented to the public as diversity programs. There's currently Drive for Diversity. Can you talk about the effectiveness of programs like Drive for Diversity that NASCAR has launched?
Like I stated earlier, it's photo opportunities. If you put kids in pictures, it's hard to sit up here on the stage or in the press and attack kids. And NASCAR, they know that. They're not going to say, we're trying. It's going to take 10, 20, 50 years to develop a driver. We got to get hundreds of kids out here, and a certain percentage of them will be interested. But it's strictly for photo ops, and that looks contrived, too, because you can't attack the kids. I mean, it's almost like World War II, the Geneva Convention. They told the Allied forces, you can't bomb the churches and cathedrals that have been around for hundreds of years. But then the Allied forces are outside the cathedral, and the Germans are shooting through the windows, but you can't shoot back because you can't destroy the cathedral. That's the kind of tactics that I see, that presents.
And it's touched on in the book here in pretty great detail. Can you talk about the hostility that you've experienced, again, in the grandstands, but can you also talk about the hostility that a driver like Chris Woods, a black driver, who was part of your program down at Concord, North Carolina, talk about the hostility that this experienced.
Yeah, there's a lot of, especially when you show up for the first season, a black driver or a black team looks at as a threat, that you're coming into the sport, and this is the only sport that's left for white people, and now we're going to lose this. So what happens is the crash damage, which gets in the sponsorship budget, it increases about 30% or 50% for a black driver because they're trying to wreck you and go out of the way and put you into the wall and wreck your equipment. And to get around that, you have to be a good racer, but you need more budget to satisfy that. And maybe two cars, so while you're trying to repair the wrecked car in 5 nights to get ready for the next weekend, you have another car to go out and race. So the black driver has a tough way to go. It's totally isolated on the racetrack, and they're trying to wreck you. Which is described in the book with Chris Woods in the early 90s, even if a car is out of contention, a lap down, 5 laps down, and they see the black driver coming around in their mirrors, they will try to knife him into the wall and just put him out of contention.
And would you talk a little bit, Lenny, about a character in the book named David Miller, no relation. But talk about him and talk about how he plays into the stereotype of the fan base.
Yeah, David Miller, he's a southerner from North Carolina, from the Concord area, and he was loyal to us for about 8 years, from 1994, into 2001. And he saw, we arrived in town, he saw that what we were trying to do, and he believed in our effort. He actually stopped racing and helped us as a chief mechanic for that 8-year period. And what was good about that, he was part of the system. So he would tell my father and I what people are saying behind our back. Anything from calling names, threats. We've been threatened to have tools taken out of our race shop. And then David Miller would tell us about that, and we would prepare for that to prevent all those type of episodes.
And we would get the tools back.
And then since my father and I mean, we're real racers, we talk to everyone and sort out, who are the good people, who are the bad people, and then we would get allies, in racing, where in the past, NASCAR would bring in a Magic Johnson, or they had Dr. J, they thought they could go out and just race almost like a driving down the highway, I-95, and didn't realize how technical it is and detailed and all the hard work. And they never talked to any of the real racers because they barely came to the track. Again, it was ceremonial.
And Mr. Miller, Can you take us up to the present day? Just a few weeks ago, we addressed a group of motorsports journalists just up the road in Trevose, Pennsylvania. Can you talk about behind the scenes what happened there?
On January 16th of this year, 2010, you, Lenny, and myself got hit with 1950s racial tactics by executive at NASCAR. We were scheduled to speak at the Eastern Motor Press Association at Trevose, Pennsylvania, at the Radisson Hotel, which is up here at the end of the Roosevelt Boulevard. And the president got us at 8 o'clock in the morning as we came in, and it said that a NASCAR executive had called Tuesday and told him that if either one of those Millers speak, that they were going to withdraw all sponsorship to the association. And that was like stunning in 2000. This is 2010, and this is going back to pre-civil rights era way of doing things. And that really took me back with some things I could talk all night about. But the president went let Lenny speak. And that he was tired of being a president, so he stepped down as the president of the Eastern Motor Press Association. And he's a fine fellow, and he stood up and met the roll call. So that's 2010. You don't have that in the NFL. You don't have that in tennis. You don't have that in the other sports. Even in polo. Even in polo, you could go in with the real blue bloods of the world and still get some respect. But that's low in this day and time.
So far tonight, we've just scratched the surface on all the challenges that both of you guys have faced over the years. What inspires you to keep going?
Well, I'm in a unique situation. My father, the Black American racers in the 70s, with Benny Scott as the driver, they competed, my father said earlier, in the top 60 teams in the world against Al Unser, Mario Andretti, and Jody Scheckter in Formula 5000 cars at the Long Beach Grand Prix in 75, Watkins Glen, Riverside, and in Formula Super B racing at all the road courses in the U.S., and my father even sent a driver in the 70s over to England to Brands Hatch, Mallory Park, and Silverstone to be developed in Formula Ford. And road racing is 10 times more sophisticated at every level, from a technical level, cultural level, and it's a global sport. And it's much more difficult to drive a road racer than a stock car. So if I see success as a kid at those levels, which is like going to outer space, I didn't see how, I didn't see it impossible to compete in NASCAR or stock cars and actually win at any level, including the top level. So that inspiration keeps me going. I know it's down to the corporate sponsorship and the resources. And just like my father mentioned, Antron Brown, he has the resources in drag racing, so he wins, and he's black and he dominates.
Yes. Well, I could sit here and speak to you gentlemen for hours about all the experiences that you've been through and the struggles and the triumphs, too, I should add. I hope you all do get a chance to read the book, because there are triumphs indeed in the book. But right now I want to make sure our audience gets involved. So please raise your hand if you have a question. And if you have a question, just allow the microphone to reach you first before you ask. And don't be shy. Okay, this gentleman right here.
Instead of saying to the Millers, to the Miller brothers, because I've probably known the father and the son and love him to death. Even one time went all the way up to Binghamton, Vermont, shined the window on the car, and we came in second.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's right. Out of 30 cars.
Okay. I mean, it's really painful to hear them have to repeat these stories because, you know, the two of them and I have talked so many times. We watch eras where a Walter Payton, they would go after him because they wanted his name. He had no talent drivers, but they wanted to use his name to make us feel good in our communities. They had teams that were talented, couldn't attract sponsors. We're still talking 2010. They're still not getting sponsors. What are we going to do about this?
Well, that's the dilemma. I mean, in auto racing, you have to go to a corporation to get the support. It's not like the NFL where you're dealing with a sanctioning body that can talk to a team owner or you come through the school system where if you're a great college basketball player, you probably have a chance at the NBA if you're in that top 1%. Auto racing is family-oriented. I don't think even the best drivers are competing. The drivers that are competing are the ones that have the resources or a family name. And if you go to McDonald's, McDonald's is McDonald's. That's a separate corporation, so you can't just throw them into the same pot as a Budweiser. And because they're all individual companies with individual products. So you run into the same dilemma at all these companies where they just want to escort you to diversity and you just can't get enough resources to compete.
The three ways for the black athlete to progress in Americans, now in the motorsports especially, there's only three ways. One is a white angel. Number two is the boycott. And number three is superhuman strength. They're the three. If you remember, that Jackie Robinson had Branch Rickey. Branch Rickey's best friend deserted him and never spoke to him the rest of his life. Here, we don't have the white angel in NASCAR. NASCAR's trying to stop us from speaking. You know, it's like pre-civil rights days. It's hard now to boycott because the black community is split. But in being split, we can't get enough momentum to go after people. For example, when Nextel sponsored NASCAR, it was like $70 million a year they paid. $70 million. If you remember, Nextel was started the black community and the construction community, were the two communities that kept Nextel going. Then they merged in with Sprint. When they merged in with Sprint, then a whole new culture comes up. But what really, in that area, we should, in certain corporations, we should not buy their products, just like everyone else. You don't need to be out demonstrating. Just don't buy the product. Just don't buy the product. And superhuman strength and racing doesn't work. If I remember neighbors of Serena and Venus Williams, Randy Thomas, which some people in here, neighbors, they said that Venus and Serena, 11 years old, the court had glass on it, and it cracked, and when it hit the ball spin all that, and they had to learn to keep that ball in play all the time. You need a $100,000 race car to get started, and you can't show your skill because no one will give you the money to do it. But there are the three ways.
This gentleman right here.
Very interesting listening to you and all. I have a larger question, and this is 2010. And you know, I look at the situation with, raising funds and trying to do this. But there's a larger question here. This is 2010. African Americans in this country have an annual disposable income of over $700 billion annually. When are we going to step up to the plate and get it? Because everybody knows the old saying, old Southern expression, money talks and you know it walks. Okay? we have this income and we have this thrust, but we're fighting amongst one another. All right, and I don't care how prejudiced a person is or whatever, there's one equalizer in this country because it's a capitalistic society, and that's the green dollar. The green dollar doesn't know any color or anything else. And until we step up to the plate and fend for ourselves to a large degree, a lot of this is just going to continue. Like your opinion on that.
Yeah, we have an interesting scenario. We had in Baltimore, there was a black-owned oil company called OMO Petroleum. And he had contracts with FedEx, CSX Railroad, and a few other companies. So he sponsored, at the time, he had a female driver. It was a white female driver, Breanne Cronrath. And he started out to sponsor us, and he started sending us checks, $25,000, $50,000. He was getting more contracts. He wanted to spend millions. On your point to be self-contained, have an African-American sponsor team, and take care of herself. He was so proud that he could do that, that he showed photos to some of his contractors, and he said, hey, got a NASCAR team, we're going to have a marketing program. And then all of a sudden, within 6 months, he lost all the contracts. They said, hey, these guys are going to come in self-contained, they're powerful. He's feeding money into a NASCAR team to help promote his oil company, which is a traditional way to present an oil company or market an oil company. And then he went out of business because he needed the contracts from these other Fortune 500 companies. And some of them were in NASCAR, some were not, but they were fans of NASCAR and understood it and took offense and were threatened that he sponsored our team, so that went away.
Another side of the issue, this is a real poignant story and 4 years old. A lot of the Washington Redskins black players have these tuner cars, have these custom cars, and these SUVs that they put in $80,000, $100,000 into. Well, in the Washington, D.C. area, the best speed shop is a black-owned speed shop. It's the best. Not the second best. It's the best. Why is he the best? He has all of the machinery that you can do to build any kind of motor. So some of the folks, like our type of folks, to say, go over to his shop and see if he'll do the motors for you. So he quoted the motors for these Washington Redskins players. I'm talking about five players. I'm not talking about like one player. He quoted a motor $14,200. To go back to the Redskins, I know the coach or who was involved, but they said, don't go over there to the black guy. The blacks don't know so-and-so. So he goes to the white speed shop down the road that's a friend of the black owner. And the white speed shop owner sold them the motor for $17,500. Subcontracted the whole motor to the black guy for $14,200. The five black Redskin players were running around pounding their chest in Washington, D.C. Who got the best? His blood stuff is good. And I didn't go to that man. And he was hurt. He was totally hurt. Now, this is the type of thing that we can't get into black self-hatred either, but we can get in a lot of those stories. So we're almost alone out here.
And there's always a solution to the problem. So to try to get around what we just described, we're pushed out into international waters. I would say we'd have to get a company from China, India, England, South America, and bring them into the U.S. Because if they do business in the U.S. or maybe they want to increase their business in the U.S. and then offer auto racing as a platform for that. And some of these other foreign countries, they don't have the same prejudices that the U.S. has because they're older countries and they've been through all that.
And that's what I say. We've looked at drivers in South Africa and even have pinpointed some companies, you know, outside of the U.S.
This gentleman right here.
Lenny and Leonard, you know, we've been friends for a long time. My name is Ron Hines. I'm going to ask you.
He's in the book.
Thank you.
Both books.
I'm going to ask you to talk about two things. One, what did it take to win the track championships in South Carolina? Is it North Carolina or South Carolina?
It was North Carolina. The track championship was in Manassas, Virginia. That was in 2005 with Franklin Butler.
Okay. Talk about how you were able to achieve that. And secondly, I'd like you to give a few remarks about Benny Scott, the great road racing driver who died last year, and how Viceroy Cigarettes sponsored that team and enabled you to compete on a national level.
Okay, on the track championship in 2005 at Old Dominion Speedway, we won the track championship with a white driver, Franklin Butler. And Franklin Butler, and he had a brother, they were winning drivers at the late model level, and Franklin Butler even was very competitive and had wins at higher levels. And that brings up a point where even some white drivers in NASCAR, they're pushed out of the sport because they don't have the money to compete, because again, it's not like basketball or football. And Franklin Butler and his brother, Brandon Butler, were one of those drivers. So we had, when you're trying to develop a black driver from scratch, you have to do it in steps. You can't go out like a white team and just take the best driver, put them in the car, and get instant results or get results in the first or second season. So Franklin Butler was an overqualified driver for that level of racing. And that's what some of the top teams are. They just get the best driver, the best of everything and the resources, and you go out there and you'll probably be in the top 10 or top 3 off of the trailer. And then we bought the best mechanic for that level of racing, Herman Gant. And a lot of crews at that level are volunteer crews. So we started out paying. We offered some money, and there were times we didn't have money, and they went strictly volunteer. And we offered winnings, and they've never even been treated that way in a business manner at that level of racing. Because again, Father, we started out on the world stage, and now we're down at the grassroots level, applying, you know, IBM and Coca-Cola principles in a grassroots level of racing. So we put all those elements together, and in Franklin Butler, he would, as a white driver, he didn't get crashed as much as a black driver. He was so good, he was always 1, 2, or 3 in a race, so he avoided most of the crashes. And we actually lived on 2005 off of the race winnings. We all agreed to put most or all of the race winnings back into the team. And that's how we won the championship in 2005. And then we sent that information down to NASCAR as the first black owners to win a championship, and then never heard from them. Because we're not in the diversity program, we can't be controlled. But if that was a diversity driver in their diversity program, that would have made... It would have made the front page of USA Today, but it would have been in the NASCAR publications and some of the grassroots publications.
Benny Scott was a driver that fit into the third category that I mentioned a while ago, a superhuman. Benny Scott was studying on a PhD. He could mold fiberglass panels, he could develop fiberglass, he could build motors along with Ron. He knew rear ends, he knew all about dynamics, wind channels. He was like a genie in a bottle. It's how good. And get in and drive the car. And even Benny, we never could get enough practice. Like, we had to go 200 miles an hour, and he still didn't get the practice that the other drivers get. Because we never, in other words, we're running on $1 million, and we should be running on $2 million. But we still competed with the top teams in the world, and we never, even to this day, in all the days of racing, that some of the fellows like Alex in here, Kenny Wright, Ron, and in that been with us over the years, we've never been put on the trailer the first time. We've never been put on the trailer. And in stock car racing, we've always qualified for every race. I don't care who you're talking about. And somehow that's all looked at as a threat. They like us running in the back and you know, getting some watermelon or something on a pit stop. Excuse me.
Sure, go ahead.
I have a few questions. One is, how do you plan to, or are there plans to train young people in stock car racing? One question. Second question, why this sport? Why the pushback against people of color in race car driving? And also, who regulates this sport?
Yeah, I know NASCAR is a privately owned company. It's not like the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, where you have commissioners and boards and bylaws. They have those things, but it's controlled by one family. So there's not really any regulation. And to train a black driver, I mean, you really have to come up, you know, like with a father and son team or family oriented effort to get started, and a lot of times we don't have that. It's rare, you know. So again, you take Antron Brown, you take his dad. They're rare, but that's what it takes to get to the top. So that's a problem, and then you have to have disposable income to start out on your own, whether it's go karts or entry level drag racing team or effort. You have to have that disposable income. And that's where we're lacking.
The other thing I would like to add, that out of the 14 black drivers that we've developed, 10 had no fathers. 10 out of 14, and that caused that with some other issues involved there.
And then one more point, which you have Mark Davis out there on the circuit now, who doesn't have any sponsorship. You start out with Joe Gibbs Racing, the ex-former coach of the Redskins, but they were let go, or I don't know what the details are. But the father who just passed, he put all of his disposable income into the son, went through his 401k, depleted that, remortgaged the home. Inner things you have to do. But Mark Davis, when he hit 18, 19 years old, then you have to make a decision. If you're not moving up the ladder, what do you do? Most race car drivers don't have a college degree. It's a blue-collar sport. They're making a living on racing if they can get a break. So then as an African-American, you're at a crossroads when your driver son hits 18. Do you want to be blue-collar or professional? So if you're going to be blue-collar, you have to forego college education and try maybe another 10 years till you're 28 or 12 years till you're, you know, almost 30 and not have a college education. Or you have to back off and go to college. And that's happened to a lot of African-American drivers, too, because you can't see the future. It's not guaranteed. So, well, I better go to college and get a professional degree so at least I can make a living, because I may not be able to make a living driving race cars full time.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we are just about out of time.
Uh-oh, that's a long time, huh?
But that's not a problem, because we're just going to move this discussion into the lobby where we will be signing books, and where those of you who haven't already purchased a book and would like to purchase a book will be able to do so. So I would like to thank Leonard T. Miller, the author of Racing While Black. I want to thank Leonard W. Miller, who, among all of the other accolades we've mentioned tonight, is also an author in his own right, who wrote the book Silent Thunder, which would you maybe call that Racing While Black Part 1, the prequel?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, okay, very good. So thank you.
The gentleman had a question. He wanted to know what planes do you fly?
777, Boeing 777.
Okay, I want you to go to my company and see if they can sponsor you, okay?
Okay, I'll talk to you.
All right.
I'll talk to you here in a few minutes.
I want to thank the Philadelphia Free Library, our hosts, and I want to thank all of you, the audience. So give yourselves a round of applause. And one more time, Racing While Black, how an African-American stock car team, I'm stumbling there, made its mark on NASCAR. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Hey, Doc, we got all the points in.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.